Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Emily Koenig of the law firm of Sherman and Howard, registration number 22634. I intend to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I understand it's my responsibility to cut myself off at that time. I am before this honorable court on behalf of Dr. Crino and Dr. Dobbins. The claims at issue are conspiracy, fraud, and defamation. This is a case of a doctor working in a relatively large firm who disliked certain policy and who disliked certain of his colleagues. In fact, his dislike was so strong that he chose to resign his employment and sue the firm and a number of his former colleagues. The record and the errors in the trial court below, whether with respect to instruction or sufficiency of the evidence, compel that the judgment against my clients cannot stand. I'm not contagious, by the way. The plaintiff was a doctor in a professional services group, South Denver Anesthesiologists. In its business structure, SDA is much like any law firm, accounting firm, or other physicians group. SDA provides anesthesia. Its clients are surgeons in hospitals, in emergency rooms, at surgery centers, and for obstetricians. In concert with these surgeons and OBs, SDA provides patients with anesthesia. SDA was presented in 2007 with a business need to employ a policy with respect to how and on what timing its physicians would provide anesthesia for certain OB procedures. Dr. Nash did not like the policy, and he had a personal objection to performing the anesthesia as prescribed in the policy. But he nonetheless chose to support the policy and voted in favor of its implementation. Though he was permitted to and even commended for his decision to withdraw from this particular part of SDA's anesthesia provision, that is with respect to these certain OB cases, because he felt it would compromise his personal conviction. The firm, his partners, commended him for that decision, but he was nonetheless angry in the wake of the new policy implementation. Among others, Dr. Nash sued two of his business partners, Dr. Crino, who was then president of the SDA board, and Dr. Dobbins, who was one of the physicians at SDA who served obstetricians and their patients. With respect to conspiracy, there is no basis upon which the conspiracy claim should ever have gotten to the jury. With respect to fraud, we still, after years in this litigation, a protracted trial, and now appellate briefing in this matter, do not know what Dr. Nash alleges are the specific fraudulent statements upon which he relied to his detriment. With respect to defamation, the allegedly defamatory statements were substantially true, but the trial court rejected the instruction on plaintiff's obligation to prove falsity. The allegedly defamatory statements were privileged and had to do with SDA's business and the business of OB anesthesia. Nonetheless, the trial court ruled in
contrary. Let me ask you a question so we get this thing moving a little bit more, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
The only defamation claim here is a defamation per se claim against Dr. Crino. That's all we have left, right?
Correct.
Did the trial court find that all 9 of those statements included in Instruction 24 were defamatory per se as a matter of law?
The trial court did, Your Honor, and it's our contention that that was improper.
Okay. And it's your contention, as I understand and feel, that 3 of those statements are not defamatory per se, correct?
That is correct.
And those are the only 3 statements you ask us to look at as being not defamatory per se. The other 6 you're not raising on appeal, is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
They are either not defamatory per se or do not pertain to Dr. Nash.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to get that clear.
I would like to focus first on the conspiracy claim. Your Honors, this claim never should have gone to the jury. It's important to keep in mind with respect to this claim that the jury concluded that Dr. Dobbins had not engaged in any underlying tortious conduct. The threshold question with respect to the conspiracy claim is the proof of the agreement. The trial court denied the Rule 50 motion because she ruled that the jury could find an inference of an agreement. And the case law, Your Honors, is contrary to this ruling. There are 2 times where Drs. Crino and Dobbins crossed paths. One, a call from Dr. Dobbins to Dr. Carino in early March of '08 requesting that Dr. Carino call Dr. Voss regarding certain concerns that she had. And two, Dr. Dobbins' letter after one of Dr. Nash's vitriolic emails about Dr. Dobbins' concerns related to Dr. Nash in light of that email.
Let me ask you about the conspiracy issue a little bit, as I understand what's in the briefs. First of all, let me try to clarify, much as Judge Richmond did on the fraud claim. The plaintiff characterizes your claim as being a claim having to do with the improper jury instruction. You say your claim is a sufficiency of the evidence claim and not a jury instruction claim. Am I understanding your argument correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. We did not contest the conspiracy instruction. We contested whether that issue should go to the jury at all.
Okay. So do you agree that a conspiracy, proof of an agreement, can and often is proved by circumstantial evidence?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So what is the difference between that and making a reasonable inference from circumstantial evidence, which the jury was also instructed they could make reasonable inferences from the evidence? What's the difference between using circumstantial evidence to prove an agreement and what we have here?
It's our contention, Your Honor, that there was no circumstantial evidence. There were two instances where Dr. Carino and Dr. Dobbins crossed paths. That is, even if inference were the standard as opposed to proof, that would not satisfy the standard. I understand Your Honor's question with regard to where does one cross the line from drawing inferences to offering proof. And it's our contention, Your Honor, that the trial court judge in this case had heard all of the evidence and was fully capable of and should have ruled that there was not sufficient evidence for this claim to go to the jury. She articulated her decision with respect to this inference standard, but the case law, Your Honor, both Moore versus Johnson and Nelson versus Elway, makes clear that there must be proof of an agreement, not an inference of one, and that's the standard on which the judge permitted that claim to go to the jury.
The claim is it wasn't proof, however you characterize it.
Even if the standard were an inference, there wasn't evidence upon which one could infer an agreement, because there were two times when Dr. Dobbins and Dr. Carino crossed paths.
And you're saying they crossed paths, counsel. You're saying they didn't know each other? They never communicated to each other except on these two occasions?
No, I'm sorry.
There was evidence that they were in the same practice together and they knew each other, correctly?
Absolutely. They were partners. They were business partners. They knew each other. They were friends. They had been in business together for quite some time. But with respect
to... Why couldn't the jury have inferred from the way things turned out that they had communicated to each other and had some sort of a tacit agreement about this?
There was no evidence of that, Your Honor.
But it's always inferential, isn't it? In every case, you don't have direct evidence that someone conspired. They don't write down an agreement and say we're going to conspire.
Hopefully not. But there was the only evidence offered by plaintiff in this case of an instance where Dr. Dobbins and Dr. Carino crossed paths with respect to Dr. Nash and these issues surrounding his objection to the policy and his provision of services to SDA's clients. Was one, a call from Dr. Dobbins to Dr. Carino saying that Dr. Dobbins would like Dr. Carino to call Dr. Voss, who was an OB practicing at Sky Ridge. That's instance number one.
After Dr. Carino had talked to Dr. Voss about the demise case, right?
No.
Carino talked to Dr. Voss about the demise case, and then, excuse me, Dobbins talked to Voss about the demise case, and then Dobbins called Carino and said, you need to talk to Dr. Voss, in effect, right?
Dr. Dobbins overheard a discussion on the OB floor that he understood Dr. Voss also had overheard, and he contacted Dr. Carino to have Dr. Carino contact Dr. Voss with respect to coverage of this particular kind of OB process.
So Dr. Dobbins never spoke to Dr. Voss first? I believe he did. And then he reported to Carino. And then Carino called Dr. Voss. I believe that's what the evidence was.
I believe Dr. Dobbins spoke to Dr. Voss on the OB floor that day.
Correct. And then he spoke to Carino. And then Carino spoke to Voss.
Correct. But Dr. Dobbins' call to Carino was simply to say, I believe Dr. Voss has some concerns, and would you please call her? So that's instance number one where they cross paths. Instance number two where they cross paths is Dr. Dobbins' letter that he wrote and sent to first Dr. Carino and then subsequently to the entire board that said he had concerns in light of and in the wake of Dr. Nash's vitriolic email about Dr. Nash's state of mind and performance of his obligations at that time. There's absolutely no other evidence of the two of them crossing paths. And that's simply, even if the standard were lowered to an inferential one as opposed to a proof, that would not satisfy that standard. There simply is not sufficient evidence in the record to support the judgment or to have even permitted this claim to go to the jury. Secondly, with respect to conspiracy, it's important to remember that Resolution Trust Company versus Husman clearly states the requirement that all parties to a conspiracy must be acting tortiously. And again, to keep in mind the fact that the jury concluded that Dr. Dobbins had not engaged in any underlying tortious activity.
Doesn't Heiserman say this? Defendants assert that to be subject to joint liability, the actors must knowingly agree to engage in conduct that is known at the time of the agreement to be tortious. It says that, doesn't it? And in the next sentence, it says, we do not agree with that position. There must be a conscious and deliberate decision to pursue a common plan, but the actors need not have a specific intent to commit a tortious act. Isn't that contrary to the argument you just made?
I believe, Your Honor, that the court there is speaking with respect to the intent of the parties to the alleged conspiracy at the time they undertake it. I think that there's a distinction to be made in this and perhaps many other cases where conspiracy is alleged, that there was not the allegation either at the time Drs. Carino and Dobbins were communicating, or even at the time of trial, that they had undertaken with some tortious intent. I think that the reference that we make with respect to the parties having to be acting tortiously is that in the end, when the conspiracy is effected and completed, there has to be evidence that the parties in concert engaged in that tortious activity that results in meeting the requirements of a conspiracy.
Well, the instruction to which you didn't object, which you just told Judge Loeb you didn't object to, says that the defendants agreed by words or conduct to accomplish a goal through unlawful means. If the goal here, as Dr. Nash suggests, was to deprive him of his income, does it make any difference whether they agreed to commit a defamation or they agreed to commit a fraud? Because it says they agreed to accomplish a goal through unlawful means. The unlawful means here was defined as causing him to lose his income. Couldn't the jury have found on that basis that there was a conspiracy violation of his instructions?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that the evidence supports that.
About a minute left, if you wanted to take a little, save some time for your rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Ann Gill. My registration number is 14610. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Judd Nash. I intend to split my time, if questioning permits it, with Michael Mills, who was trial counsel. This case, in which many of the appellate issues revolve around sufficiency of the evidence, arises out of a 7-day jury trial. After 7 days of evidence, the jury returned a verdict finding that there had been a conspiracy, defamation, and fraud committed by these doctors. For our purposes of appeal, I'd like to address the standard of review and the preservation of issues. Mr. Mills intends to address the sufficiency of the evidence. The standard of review on the sufficiency of the evidence is de novo, which should work in the appellant's favor. But when the sufficiency of evidence is challenged on appeal, the court must review all of the evidence. I think if you read the transcripts of the trial, you'll find that there are sharp disputes about quite a few circumstances in this case. But as part of that review, it has been said in a number of cases that it's the sole province of the jury to resolve disputed issues of fact and determine the credibility, the weight to be accorded to the testimony, and the inferences to be drawn from the evidence.
Well, this might not be your department, but there's an issue of law here. Did the judge find, as a matter of law, that all nine of the alleged defamatory statements were defamatory per se?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in your brief, you say she did not make such a finding. That's a mistake in your brief?
I believe that is a mistake in your honor.
Page 29 in your brief. The trial court did not make a ruling that all of the alleged defamatory statements were defamatory per se. You're now saying that's a mistake in your brief.
I believe that is a mistake, okay. Your Honor.
Where did she make a ruling then?
In the jury instruction conferences, that was addressed in the Volume 7 at pages 163 through 169. At the conclusion of that discussion of those statements that are in that challenged instruction, the court asks of counsel, is there anything here that you argue is not clearly defamatory? And defense counsel says, sorry, Your Honor, I flipped the page. We've already discussed 2 and 7. I think we're okay with it, as modifications have been made. I believe that the judge indicated that those all were defamatory per se. I believe that was Mr. Mills' position in that conference, and I believe that the appellants did not preserve that issue for purposes of appeal by that concession there of not making an objection when the judge asks, is there anything that you argue is not really defamatory?
Then if we conclude, we were to conclude that one of these three statements, which they now say they're challenging on appeal, is not defamatory per se, does that require reversal of that verdict?
If you find that the issue was preserved, I think that could lead to a reversal of the defamation verdict.
I believe at that page you were referring to, Ms. Colazzi said we object to 2 and 7 as being not defamatory per se. I think she said that's what you said, right?
I believe that if you read the pages 163 through 169, the conclusion of it is that they have made modifications to those, and the conclusion is that they have been made modifications, and that as modifications, it is okay.
So they're no longer objecting, but on appeal, they're certainly objecting. You're saying in this record, it looks like they're no longer objecting to 2 and 7. It's hard to tell, but now on appeal, they certainly are objecting to 3 of the statements as not being defamatory per se.
Correct, yes.
But your position is we only would have to review those 3, none of the other 6, correct?
Right, and I believe that those are defamatory per se. Number 1 is clearly referring to the demise case and Dr. Nash's handling of it. Number 2, I believe also is the handling. And then I believe was number 7.
Because of the way Dr. Matt Nash handled the demise case, we are now considering looking at other anesthesia groups to provide coverage of Skyridge. That's number 7.
Yeah. Right, and that's a defamatory because it goes to the business and the professional standard of care. It's talking about his performance in his profession, which would be defamatory per se.
Counsel, this may be Mr. Mills' bailiwick, but I'm still trying to figure out what the alleged basis was for the $86,000 in damages that the jury awarded on defamation?
Your Honor, there were a number of components of damage, and in this case, the tort claims were intertwined because our position is that there was a conspiracy, there was a deceit by fraud, there was defamation, and there was a constructive discharge. It's hard to separate those out individually, but there's evidence of a number of specific items, and all of these things go to the fact that Dr. Nash's reputation was harmed through the defamation. He took certain acts in reliance on the fraud, and he was constructively discharged.
But how do you get $86,000? I mean, there's got to be some way. I mean, on the constructive discharge, I get it. I mean, you had an expert, she came up with a range. The jury seemed to be in the middle. Where does $86,000 come from? I don't find it anywhere in the record.
Your Honor, it's always difficult to quantify the damages from defamation, but the loss of reputation went to the employment that Dr. Nash was able to find afterwards because he could not go to another large group. The only other large anesthesiology group was one which had heard the defamatory remarks. It impacted where he could work and his ability to earn income in the future.
So if you're right about that, does that mean that the $86,000 and then the $172,000, that's another issue as well, that's incorporated in the full amount that the jury gave for the constructive discharge?
No, that is not my position. The evidence of damages was submitted to the jury, and because there were not special interrogatories, we don't know which specific components the jury decided were comprised of defamation damages, fraud damages, conspiracy damages, or the constructive discharge damage. In the absence of a special interrogatory asking the jury to explain which component they assigned to each tort, we simply do not know, and we have to assume that the jury followed its instructions and that there is evidence of damages. And Mr. Mills will address that in greater detail, Your Honor.
Save some more questions from here for him then.
If you would please. I do think that preservation of issues on appeal is a major component in the doctor's appeal, and that they did not clearly object to the defamatory statements. I think that they did not object to the jury instruction on including false representations on the instruction that led to the fraud verdict. And I would ask that you do not reach those issues, the failure to preserve the issues for purposes of appeal. I did want to very quickly say that I believe that the falsity is not an element of a defamation claim as against a private person in a private setting, and that the cases cited that do discuss falsity always involve either a public figure or a matter of public interest. At this time, I'd like to turn the podium over to Mr. Mills.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Mills of Mills, Schmitz & Zlotek. My attorney registration number is 34859. I believe it's critical that any analysis of the defendant's attempt to overturn this jury's verdict in the 7-day case start with the clear understanding that the OB complaint never occurred. Once you understand that the OB complaint never occurred, that Dr. Nash spoke with no one outside of SDA about that demise case, that Dr. Furr testified that Dr. Furr was the primary physician for the demise patient, and he testified that he never received any request for confirmation of the demise or for an ultrasound or for a fetal heart tone monitor. No witness contradicts or no evidence contradicts that Dr. Nash did not provide care for that demise patient because the case was resolved before Dr. Nash came on duty. With that understanding, if an event didn't occur, the nurses could not have been discussing an event that didn't occur. There was nothing to talk about. If the nurses weren't discussing it, then Dr. Dobbins' testimony that he overheard the nurses contradicts the rest of the evidence in the case.
If you cross-examine Dr. Dobbins and ask him whether he did anything to verify what he heard claimed to have overheard the nurses saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was his answer to that question?
Your Honor, he never tried to confirm anything that he had heard?
He just went off and he talked to Dr. Voss about what he thought had happened.
That's
basically what your version is.
He also testified that he didn't turn around to see who the nurses were. These are nurses on the OB floor that he works with on a daily basis for years. He knows them all, but he never turned around to see who had this negative impression of his firm, SDA.
Did he then tell Dr. Carino what he had heard from what he had told Dr. Voss?
That is their allegation, yes. They believe that he then reported to Dr. Carino what he heard from the nurses. It's our belief that the communication probably went the other direction. Since the OB, the demise case never occurred and Dr. Nash never did anything with it, the nurses couldn't have been talking about it. The only people that knew were the management of SDA, which would have been Don Carino and several others.
Carino went and talked to Dr. Voss about it, and we have all that testimony. Let me ask you about your fraud claim. When you pled it, you said false statements were made to the board by Dr. Carino, and the board relied on them. That's what your complaint says. By trial, you had a different theory on the fraud, correct? By trial, your fraud theory was false statements were made to Dr. Nash, on which he relied to forego various things to try to protect his job. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I think it's both. We probably would find it more fully explained by trial, since notice pleading didn't require a full explanation. Dr. Nash was a member of the board at all times. He was representing all of the objecting physicians in the entire group with the board discussions about changing the policy. 1 month prior to all of this, they had a vote to change the OB policy to something substantially similar. That failed by a vote of 5-2. After these representations to Dr. Nash, that there was a complaint about him, that they were going to lose the entire multi-million dollar contract because of him, multiple members, multiple physicians testified at court that they changed their position based on that. As did Dr. Nash, he changed his position. He quit advocating for those who opposed it.
So he relied on the statements that Dr. Carino had made to him, which Dr. Carino had attributed to Dr. Voss, correct?
That's correct.
How was he damaged in the amount of $86,000 by virtue of that reliance? Same question that Judge Loeb had.
Well, Your Honor, I can tell you how he was damaged. I can't tell you how the jury came up with that particular figure because nobody asked the jury to break it out. Nobody asked for a reasoned verdict or special interrogatories on the verdict form.
But did you ever ask the jury, did you ever tell the jury, these are the damages that I want for this claim, and here's how I get to that figure?
Your Honor, because all of these different torts converge to create one set of damages, there was no damage that you could carve out and say this damage is particular to defamation and not fraud. This damage only goes to the fraud.
Why shouldn't we, although they're not specifically asking for an appeal, why shouldn't we order remittitor and just take one of those damage numbers and say otherwise it's double or maybe triple counting here? You opposed the remittitor motion in the trial court, didn't you?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. There was ample evidence of damages far exceeding what the jury awarded. So to grant a remittitor, you're assuming that even though they came down significantly from what was blackboarded at trial, that somehow they've double awarded damages or something was improper about the amounts they awarded. There were over $500,000 in actual damages already sustained. Those included junior physician reduction of $130,000, a stock certificate of $15,000, compensation for removal from the OB team, $1,500 for 30 lost units and $13,600 for the actual lost shifts. $2,000 in a board stipend they took away. $49,007 of lost wages during the suspension.
How did the fraud cause any of those damages that you just referred to?
It was based on the fraud and the defamation that both Dr. Nash was removed, the stipend was taken away, the wages were reduced, they suspended him from practicing.
But if the fraud is he relied on a statement to his detriment, how was he damaged by that?
Your Honor, he relied on it, he didn't challenge it. If he had known that the complaint had never been made by Dr. Voss, he would have called for a shareholder meeting, he would have challenged it, he would not allow them to take away payment for a stock. They had no right, no basis in any document to deny him money that accrues based on his stock ownership. He would have stood up and said, we need a hearing of every shareholder in this company, we need to talk about these false allegations and what they're doing.
Did it matter? Did he have the right to call for such a meeting?
Yes, he did, Your Honor, and they testified to that. And he testified that he didn't, and that he submitted to drug testing and psychological evaluation and everything else, and didn't directly fight because he believed that a complaint had been filed, even though he knew the underlying facts were wrong.
I'll say your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's no evidence in the record whatsoever of any damages related to fraud, conspiracy, or defamation. In fact, there's not even a request from counsel with respect to those alleged damages. There is zero. On the verdict forms, the jury inserted numbers. There is no basis for those numbers. There's no evidence. There's no request from counsel for any of those numbers. The problem with respect to the defamation is that the jury could have based its verdict on any one of the nine statements. Three of them are either not per se or not related directly to Dr. Nash. The OB complaint is perhaps the greatest inference of all time. There is absolutely zero evidence in the record. In fact, there is evidence to the contrary. Dr. Dobbins did not say anything to Dr. Kreno when he called him after the hubbub on the OB floor, other than to say, I think Dr. Voss has some concerns. Can you please call her? As I understood Mr. Mills to tell this court just now, this entire case is based on the OB complaint. And the discussions that Dr. Dobbins overheard and that Dr. Kreno independently later heard from Dr. Voss and that are set forth in Exhibit 88. Exhibit 88 is the memorialization of a meeting where Dr. Kreno was speaking to Dr. Nash. Dr. Ellis was recording the meeting. There is no connection. There is no relaying of information or accusations between Dr. Dobbins and Dr. Kreno at the time Dr. Kreno calls Dr. At the time Dr. Dobbins calls Dr. Kreno to tell him, please call Dr. Voss. I think she may have concerns with respect to our service.
So your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. I know this is a bit disjointed, but that concludes the arguments in 2010 CA 1102 and 1109. So now we're going to switch gears and hear arguments for 2010 CA 1110, where the appellant is South Denver anesthesiologist. And counsel, I assume that you were sitting in the audience and heard all the procedures and everything, so you're free to start your argument whenever you want, but please identify yourself when you come to the podium.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Michael Bello. I'm from the law firm of Barenbaum Weinschenk. I'm representing South Denver anesthesiologists, or SDA as we've been calling them. My attorney number is 8198. I will reserve 3 minutes, if possible, of my argument for rebuttal. I will discuss two main issues. One is the lack of sufficient evidence for a reasonable jury to conclude that there was a constructive discharge. Then I would also like to briefly discuss the damages for alleged future losses. Those are the two components I'd like to address. And since you've already had sort of a preview with a statement of the case, I will say that SDA, as you've heard, is a large anesthesia practice with approximately 72 doctors. And SDA's success depends on its ability to provide quality patient care to assure that its client hospitals and doctors are satisfied with its services, and also to provide a collegial environment for its employees. All of SDA's actions regarding Dr. Nash were designed to achieve those objectives. Dr. Nash became increasingly difficult to work with, as evidenced by the complaint made by Mr. Qualman against Dr. Nash for a series of different incidents that showed, in Dr. Qualman's opinion, a pattern of irascible and unreasonable behavior. And that was the complaint which largely led to the conditions for offering to return Dr. Nash to work when he had been suspended. I just briefly on a constructive discharge statement of the law here. Dr. Nash must establish that SDA deliberately made his working conditions so intolerable with the intent to cause him to quit, and that a reasonable person in Dr. Nash's position would have no other choice except to resign.
You have no objection to that jury instruction. You accept that as an accurate statement of the law, right?
We do.
Okay. So the only issue here is whether the jurors erred in finding that Dr. Nash did not act reasonably, correct?
That is in part, yes, that he did not act in a reasonable manner, as a reasonable person would have done faced in his shoes.
So given the fact that there was a lot of evidence, 7 days worth, I guess, including Dr. Nash's testimony in two different volumes of the record, why should we second guess? What's in the record to allow us to sort of second guess that the jury found that Dr. Nash acted reasonably based on the circumstances when he quit?
Well, first, it's certainly not unusual to reverse a jury verdict. In the fact that the lead case in Colorado, the Wilson case, was a case of reversing a jury verdict on constructive discharge. Also, we referred to the Tatum case, which is an Eighth Circuit case, where the court said, while we are reluctant to reverse a jury verdict, as I understand that you would be, that under the circumstances, there was insufficient evidence to conclude that a reasonable person in his shoes would have found that he had no other alternative. And I think it's important to focus upon the final exchange, so to speak, of correspondence between Dr. Nash and Dr. Crino on behalf of SDA, where after Dr. Nash had gone to what they call the CPHP, and that was, by the way, was occasioned by the complaint from Mr. Qualman. Mr. Qualman was absolved of any liability in this case. And there's no evidence on which the jury could have concluded that the Qualman complaint was in any way instigated by SDA. Those conditions that SDA wanted to discuss with Dr. Nash when there was the occasion of returning him to work were basically five conditions. He testified that three of those conditions would not have given him any pause. They were, you have to take ownership of your actions. You have to agree to abide by the non-harassment policy. He testified at court that he would not have had any problems complying with those. What were left with is two conditions. And those two conditions were that he would be put on some form of probation for a period of 6 months. That's not a self-condition that's considered to be so intolerable that a reasonable person would find that he had no choice except to resign. There are multiple cases on that point. And resigning from the board. First, resigning from the board. That's not a working condition. The constructive discharge law focuses on working conditions. The board was an extracurricular activity. It's not even a working condition. It's an optional role that may be afforded to him under the circumstances. Second, it was the PRC that recommended that he not be on the board because it caused anger and frustration that resulted in some of these disagreeable communications between him and staff or other physicians.
So interrupt you there. I may have a misunderstanding. My understanding of what the condition of taking ownership of your actions was that Dr. Nash be admit that this OB complaint was true. Is that not a correct statement? You're saying he didn't object to that particular condition, is that?
One of the things I think that's important to keep in mind here, Your Honor, is that the OB complaint, the OB dispute about what occurred at Sky Ridge, whether there was really, what the nature of the complaint from Dr. Voss was, that was 4 months prior to this particular time in question. These conditions were as a direct result of the Qualman complaint, which was totally unrelated to the incident, the occasions at Sky Ridge, or whatever exactly happened at Sky Ridge. Really, for lack of a better word, sort of a vague term, take ownership, doesn't necessarily mean that you have to admit that everything you've done was wrong. I think they were more concerned about his irascible behavior, to recognize that there was at least some basis to think that his colleagues thought that he was behaving in an irascible or uncooperative manner.
So there's an indication in the record that he did not object to that particular condition?
Right.
Where is that in the record, counsel?
We cited it in the brief,
okay.
Your Honor.
If it's in the brief, I'll find it.
It is, yeah.
Thank you.
We cited specifically for those three conditions that he said he would not have a problem with complying with those conditions.
But on page 166, right after you cite that in his testimony, he said, "I felt I was going to be pushed out of this group one way or the other. They were forcing me, as they testified, with financial penalties to get me to resign. A not good faith harassment claim had been filed. An anonymous OB complaint that was later in discovering during the course of this investigation found to be inaccurate. And then the hospital solicited a complaint at Littleton Hospital. And all these things put together, my gut feeling was that wasn't right here." Isn't that enough evidence on which a jury can find that the conditions that he was subject to were unreasonable and from his own mouth?
We would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. In the first place, there are several of these, what I call the legs of the table here, that he's tried to create, which upon scrutiny are knocked out from under the table. One of those is the OB policy. The fact that the reason why he got off the OB team was because he had religious objections to performing fetal terminations. That was going to happen regardless of whether the board was considering removing him because of the Sky Ridge complaint or issues. Another one, the Qualman complaint. The Qualman complaint, as I said, Qualman was absolved of any liability here. Those are independent actions, with the exception of one or two, which kind of overlap with the issues that occurred here about his getting off the board. But those were primarily events that had happened months before any of the conduct in question that led to the referral by the independent PRC. Three members conducted a full and independent investigation. They recommended they go to CPHP. They made these five recommendations. So there are various things, as we discussed in our brief, which upon scrutiny are not, as a matter of law, a basis on which a reasonable jury could find that he had no choice except to resign. And one of the key points here is that a constructive discharge is essentially where the employer is saying, or where it would be that the employer is preparing to discharge this employee, but they're trying to instead make it so intolerable that he or any reasonable person in his shoes would have no other alternative except to quit. Here, he was an employee with a contract. You know, he's a well-compensated anesthesiologist with a contract that provided that he couldn't simply be removed without the action of either two-thirds of the shareholders or a special independent judicial ad hoc committee with an 80% vote to the board, a recommendation to the board that he be discharged. But there was no effort by the board to try to implement any sort of discharge. To the contrary, the board was trying to return him to work. One of the other points that Mr. Mills, and I hate to overlap here, but during the argument in the Queen Anne Dobbins case, Mr. Mills talked about he would have called for a special shareholder meeting. That's what we've been saying. We've been saying that if he wanted to stay on the board, he could have called for, they would have required a shareholder meeting to have caused him to leave the board. He had recourse, even to the extent that that is a working condition.
Was he given any kind of a, like, poor employee evaluation here or anything like
no.
that? Well, so then why isn't putting him on probation kind of pushing him out the door?
The probation was related to his behavioral difficulties, as you know, and I don't want to belabor the issues that Mr. Qualman complained about, but they were just things that interactions with other physicians or with staff members that were condescending or irascible or otherwise unreasonable. So that's what the primary impetus for the probation was. It wasn't because of directly because of quality of care issues. I mean, there were some issues which came up. You probably heard about when they were proposing to move into the Littleton Hospital team on the OB team before he removed himself from the team, that there was a doctor there who said that they didn't like Dr. Nash's epidurals. You know, that was Dr. Dorr. But that wasn't the primary reason for the behavior.
Was that before or after Dr. Crino told him that there were doctors at Sky Ridge who didn't like working with him?
What Dr. Crino told them was simply that they had a doctor that they were having to remove from Sky Ridge for non-clinical issues. And then Dr. Dr. Doar asked, who was that? I said, it's Dr. Nash. And Dr. Doar then said, well, I don't really like working with him because of the problems we've had with epidurals in the past.
Why was he suspended from the practice from April till June with pay, I guess, but with reduced pay, as I understand it?
Well, he was suspended for 6 weeks for $63,000, $10,000 a week with pay. Now, I don't think any reasonable person could conclude that that first 6 week suspension would give somebody a reason to quit. He was then suspended for about the last 2.5 weeks without pay. The board considered that he was acting, he was recalcitrant and unable to accept any type of responsibility, even for his obstreperous behavior with other board members, and leaving aside the issues concerning what did or didn't happen at Sky Ridge. I would like to get to, well, I did want to mention the accommodations that the board extended to him, which would belie an intent. And first, though, is they suspended him with pay. He was the first shareholder who was ever suspended with pay. There have been shareholders suspended before. $63,000 for a six-week period. We don't think any reasonable person could find that intolerable. They expedited his appointment with the CPHP. He was being dilatory. He even made a comment to the CPHP that, well, he's on paid leave, so he wasn't in any particular hurry. But Dr. Krenow interceded and got an earlier appointment so they could return him to the practice. They also gave him the first opportunity to pick up the first 9 shifts on the new team when he was removed himself from the OB team. So I'd like to reserve my time, and I will deal with the damages issue when I return. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Mills of Mills, Schmitz & Zelotic. My attorney registration number is 34859. My colleague, Mrs. Gill, would like to speak to preservation issues, which are as significant in this case as they were in the case against the doctors, but because most of the testimony has been about the evidence, we decided that I would go first and address much of what was just said. There is plenty of evidence in the record that the constructive discharge occurred and that the defendant's actions were intended to force Dr. Nash to resign. Dr. Krenow testified that he had no idea what Dr. Nash's rights were. Dr. Nash testified that Dr. Krenow told him just months before all of this came down, you're not bulletproof. That was in relation to Dr. Nash standing up to the board and forcing them to follow their own guidelines. Defendants and appellants specifically discussed that they would be unable to fire Dr. Nash because the shareholders wouldn't agree to it. They would want to give him a second chance. You can see that in Exhibit WWW or in Volume 2 of the transcript. So determining that they couldn't fire him because that would require a shareholder vote and the shareholders wouldn't agree to terminate Dr. Nash, they set forth on this journey to defame Dr. Nash both to non-board member partners and to the customers. They removed him from two hospitals. They removed him from a six-year obstetrician anesthesiology practice that was his goal as a physician. He wanted to be an obstetrician anesthesiologist.
Let me ask you about the intent element a little bit.
Yes.
Assuming that the defendants did everything that you said that they did, is there any direct evidence of intent? I understand you making an argument about, well, we're going to put all this together and it circumstantially it shows they had it, but is there any evidence where anybody, any smoking gun, any admission where they say, we're doing this because we want him out?
Your Honor, as with the conspiracy, you're not going to get evidence or an admission from them that, yes, they actually said those words or put it down in a document. So
believe it or not, sometimes you do, but
I would love to have had that in this case. It would have made the evidence make crystal clear sense. But in this case, first of all, you've got the express recognition by these doctors that the position they were putting Dr. Nash in was one where he could have no hope, no light at the end of the tunnel. Dr. Sankel, who was always on the board of directors during all times relevant to this case and was the president of the board and the representative of FDA at trial, actually sent an email to his colleagues on May 30th, shortly before the actual constructive termination, and said, quote, I remain gravely concerned that the next few weeks will be viewed by Dr. Nash. I put in Dr. Nash, they used NH, which were the initials used to refer to Dr. Nash, as wrongful punishment from which there is no escape. That is the rational, objective recognition that this was so oppressive that he had no hope and no escape. That is Exhibit 126.
Said he feared that Dr. Nash would view it that way?
Yes.
Or he wanted Dr. Nash to view it that way?
He remains gravely concerned.
What does that mean?
They testified that they referred Dr. Nash to CPHP because it was an objective third-party organization that had the expertise and the skills to deal with the supposed anger management issues. Yet when CPHP came back and said, we do not find any danger of anger management in Dr. Nash, he's cleared to return immediately to work, it was after that that SDA, instead of following the advice of their chosen third-party neutral and the experts in this, then they chose to switch his suspension from with pay to without pay. Let's talk a little bit about the terms on which SDA said
that. But did that happen before CPHP returned their report? I thought Mr. Bello said it happened because his conduct continued to be obstreperous and interfering.
Your Honor, well, that's their claim. They claim that.
But in terms of chronology, it happened before CPHP. He was put on suspension without pay before CPHP finished their investigation, yes, their evaluation. You made it sound like they finished their evaluation and then they suspended him without pay, but that's not what happened.
Well, let me clarify the timeline a little bit, Your Honor. They basically claim he had this anger management issue because he sent emails that had words like startling and editorialized. They sent him to CPHP. After a thorough initial interview, CPHP immediately said, and this is a group whose sole purpose in life is to make sure that doctors are fit and safe to practice. CPHP immediately contacted them and said, no, he's cleared to go back to work. Now, the investigation and the work that they were doing was going to continue. Dr. Nash was going to get counseling based on the requirements of SDA. He was continuing to meet with CPHP, but they had cleared him to go back to work. They reported that to SDA, and SDA, contrary to their claim that they were only trying to get him back into the group faster, when CPHP says he's cleared to return to work, their response is, we're very disappointed with your finding. And then they switched it.
Where is that reflected? You're saying SDA communicated to CPHP, were disappointed with your findings?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's in the actual file of CPHP. That's the third-party file that was admitted as evidence and that the jury got to
review. Okay.
They then switch it to suspension without pay while Dr. Nash continues to try to comply. One of the things SDA has argued is that Dr. Nash can't simply quit on an instant, that he has to work through the procedures of the company and try to correct the improper action or atmosphere. That's what Dr. Nash did for months. He accepted first suspension with part pay, then suspension without pay. He went through and didn't fight the fact that they took away his board stipend and all these other monies. He submitted to psychological testing, drug testing, mental evaluation. His wife had to come in and be interviewed by CPHP to make sure there were no marital problems or financial problems that would make him unfit to practice. All of this directly put his license at risk. If CPHP had found, as SDA kept urging them to, that he had a problem, that he shouldn't be practicing, that is reportable to the licensing authority. Okay, so he works for 3 months trying to correct all of this, all the time saying, give me feedback. Did you investigate? Please tell me what the results were. At the initial meeting, Dr. Krios acknowledged that it would be improper for him to be the investigating authority on these complaints because he's the one that had all the conversation and was presenting it to Dr. Nash. They tapped Dr. Marsh. Dr. Marsh, for whatever reason, decided or declined to actually conduct the investigation. Dr. Marsh asked Nathan Carden, another...
You mean investigation into the so-called OB complaint?
Yes, Your Honor.
Wouldn't it have been simple just to go to Dr., what's her name, Furr? And ask him if this ever happened and was Nash involved? It seems so simple to have clarified it, but it seems like nobody bothered to do it. Is that what you're suggesting?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
No one went to Dr. Furr and said, did Dr. Nash refuse to admit, did he insist on an ultrasound for this patient who was in fetal demise? And Dr. Furr would have said no, just like he said at trial.
Not until we did during the trial. We couldn't do it before that. Dr. Nash couldn't do it because, number one, he was forbidden to talk to any nurses or any doctors about it. And even though he had a suspicion it was Dr. Voss, they never disclosed who it was. They said the doctor demanded anonymity. Dr. Voss testified at trial, I never required anonymity. I've had problems with Dr. Sankel and others, and I've sat down and talked to him, and the problems resolved themselves. I would have been happy to sit down and talk to Dr. Nash. They never talked, supposedly they did talk to nurses and couldn't verify a single allegation. They could never identify a single nurse that had had these conversations that Dr. Dobbin supposedly overheard. They refused to disclose that they had investigated and couldn't corroborate any of this, despite Dr. Nash sending letters over several months and at least six letters saying, please investigate. Please tell me who these people are. Please tell them that I didn't take these steps. They never conferred with the doctor whose patient it was. And they never reported back to Dr. Nash. In fact, at the very end, when they're saying that they're willing to bring Dr. Nash back into the fold, their statement is, but you've got to accept all these things as true. And Dr. Nash testified to this. So there's evidence in the record that he was told he had to take all of these as true.
Let's take that statement. Mr. Bell said when Dr. Nash was confronted with, you've got to accept responsibility, he said, I had no problem. I'm paraphrasing. He said, I had no problem accepting responsibility, Mr. Bell told us.
So what Dr. Nash said is he has no problem accepting responsibility for his behavior. But from the day one, he said, but what you've described was not my behavior. I never took that action. I never asked for a fetal heart tone monitor. I never asked for an ultrasound. I never did these things. So I have no problem accepting responsibility for what I've done. But he was also told at the same time then he had to accept their description of what he had done, despite their knowing that their own investigation couldn't corroborate anything.
Is that based on the letter that was sent to him on around the 24th of June?
Dr. Nash testified to that as based on that letter and the conversations that they had had and email exchanges.
Also, let me ask you to move a little bit on the damages issue, because I've got a question or two about that, and I know Mr. Bello wants to talk about that in his rebuttal. And this has to do with what proof there was of the future damages. Apparently, the plaintiff, Dr. Nash, told the expert, I plan on working somewhere between ages 62 and 67. So my question is there any, do you have any case law that says that's a sufficient basis for an expert to base their calculations on that age for retirement? And if the answer to that is no, is there anything else in the record where the expert said, as a matter of custom, we accountants or experts utilize that assumption if a client tells us that? I mean, what is there in the record besides that statement?
Your Honor, you're correct that Dr. Nash, and the record reflects that Dr. Nash did tell the expert that he intended to work to age 67. Dr. Nash's father was also a physician and had worked, I believe, until that age. But Ms. Brake also testified that she also calculated 62 because those are ages typically used by experts in evaluating future damages or probable work life.
So there is testimony from her in the record to that effect?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. She testified that those are ages they typically use, 62 and 67.
My recollection of the briefs is that it just said that he intended to work till full retirement and that no specific date was given. Is that correct? You're saying he said he would work till 67?
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact,
which is correct? I said two different things.
It's correct that he said, Dr. Brake specifically testified that, that Dr. Nash informed her during the conversation while she was investigating this case that he intended to work until age 67. Let's see, I believe you can look in volume 4, page 29, starting at line 11, Your Honor. And that's also where Brake testified that she calculated age 62 as a retirement as a conservative alternative to Dr. Nash's intend to work to age 67.
Dr. Nash never testified before the jury that he intended to work to age 67. You didn't ask him that question.
No, Your Honor, but there was evidence that Dr. Nash had told her that and that that was the basis for her calculation. I don't think that that evidence needs to come from Dr. Nash to the jury, number one. Appellants are also complaining because there was only one expert in the case to do a damages valuation. Appellants had no expert. All they did was cross-examine Ms. Brake, and now they're wanting to second-guess and take away from the jury after 7 days deliberation, 7 days of trial. They want to take away from the jury their evaluation of the witnesses and their weight, the weight they gave to each witness's testimony. I'd like to give what time remains to Ms. Gill on preservation issues. I would like to point out as she's coming up here, though, that Ms. Brake Black ordered approximately $3.4 million in damages, plus Ms. Nash talked about the loss of equity in their house for another $300,000. The entire jury verdict came back far below that, so the jury clearly did some kind of computation and calculation. They did not accept everything that any witness said is true.
Excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Say she blackboarded. You mean she wrote on a piece of paper in the courtroom numbers that added up to $3.4 million?
Yeah, I believe she had
higher than what her...
I know that she testified the number's higher. I've got the numbers set out here.
Higher than what her lost compensation was, a $3.2 million dollar number that was in the report.
Absolutely. Okay. So presumably that the jury took into account some cross-examination. Mrs. Gill?
No, Mr. Mills didn't do you any favors, so you got about a minute to talk to us about preservation.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ann Gill, registration number 14610, on behalf of Dr. Nash. Either believe that appellants did not preserve their objection to the future damages based on the potential retirement age of Dr. Nash, because although they initially objected to the expert, Ms. Brake, on foundation grounds, then they actually, on cross-examination, did ask her to explain, and Ms. Brake explained that Dr. Nash had told her he planned to work to full retirement age, or 67, but that she did both the ages 62 and 67. That's in volume 4 at page 29 through page 30. Then on redirect, Mr. Brake further explained that it's customary in her field to use the ages of 62 and 67 as potential retirement ages in calculating future lost income. I'd ask you to affirm the jury verdict. It's well supported by the evidence in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bello, you got about 2.5 minutes.
I think we did preserve the objection to the expert's estimate of future damages. Ms. Kymig objected to foundation about assumptions regarding the continuing term of employment into the future. And Mr. Mills or Mr. Schmitz, trial counsel, said she's an expert, and the judge summarily overruled it. And we think we did preserve that objection. It was also in our remitter motion. But I would like to address the three critical assumptions that we think that Dr. Nash's expert made that are not based upon any facts in the record. First, it's my understanding of the record, Your Honor, that he testified, Dr. Nash testified, it's cited on page 37 of the opening brief, that he wanted to work until, quote, full retirement. The supposition or assumption that he would work to 62 to 67 was in a question from trial counsel for Dr. Nash to Ms. Brake. There was no evidence about the retirement age for anesthesiologists in general or for anesthesiologists at SDA that they would work for 22 to 27 years. Dr. Nash was 40 years old at the time of trial. The second key estimate, a key assumption that's not supported by any facts and in fact is contradicted, is that he would have an increase of 5% every year in his compensation to SDA. There were actually evidence that 2 years before, in 2008, he'd actually had a reduction in pay, and there was testimony from Mr. Qualman that the physician's incomes decreased fairly frequently.
This evidence was all put before the jury?
This is
Ms. Blake was cross-examined about that?
I assume so.
Doesn't that all just go to the weight of the evidence, Mr. Bello, yeah, as opposed to the admissibility?
Well, we don't think there's any evidence to begin with on which that assumption is based, that it's contradicted by that evidence that there was a diminution in his income.
She based the 5% on something that he'd received in the past, in the preceding years, right? Yeah. You're saying projecting into the future was improper or unsupported by the facts. But doesn't that go to the weight?
We think that they have to prove with reasonable certainty what his future damages were, that's one of the components of it, which is based upon really supposition rather than being based upon actual evidence in the record. We think Dr. Nash had choices here. At the end of this, he had the choice whether to resign or not. It was a reasonable choice, whether to stay on and at the invitation of the board, and he's those five conditions, three of which he testified were of not a great difficulty for him to meet. We believe that under the circumstances, if you review what happened, particularly focusing on this one complaint, which is not the issue in June of 2004, that there is no reasonable jury to conclude that there a reasonable man in his position would have no alternative except to resign.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.